dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been my great privilege to know for quite some time now a man whose intelligence has been an inspiration to me, whose clear-eyed view of national security and whose commitment to protect it is unsurpassed. He is Brian Kennedy these days. He is the president of a new organization he founded called American Strategy Group. You can find out all about it at amstrategy.org. For 25 years, however, he served in various capacities, including for 13 years as the president of the esteemed Claremont Institute. Among its many accomplishments, the publication of an absolutely indispensable publication, the Claremont Review of Books, which he published. And I'm very pleased to welcome Brian Kennedy back, a good friend and close colleague, and to commend him for this new project he's embarked upon, and thank him for spending a few minutes with us to talk about it and Donald Trump and national security, the subject of a piece he wrote just before the election at the Claremont Review. Welcome back, Brian Kennedy. Good to have you, my friend. Happy New Year.
Well, thank you, Frank. Happy New Year. And let me just say what a pleasure it is to be with you, and what a inspiration you've always been all these years. You've been the lone man on the wall defending the country, and I can't tell you how much all Americans should be grateful for all you've done.
Well,
all these
exceedingly
years.
Kind and entirely untrue, but deeply appreciated. Stipulate that we have a mutual admiration society. Brian Kennedy, let me ask you about this very important thought piece that you put out entitled Donald Trump and National Security. You talk about several things that I thought would be worth describing in the context now of President Trump's first days in office. You talked about the need for moral clarity, about the fact that this is a country worth defending, for starters, and the narratives that have long been used to sort of undermine that clarity, and what Donald Trump is trying, hopefully, to do to remedy that situation. Talk about all that, if you would, please.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you look at how the last administration, but many administrations operate, you know, they talk about these narratives. Now, there should be no more annoying word in the American political lexicon than narrative. Josh Ernst at the end of last year said the Obama administration was in a war of narratives with ISIS. Now, how ridiculous is that? Yes.
Or Daesh.
Yeah.
Anything but the Islamic State. We couldn't call it that under the Obama administration, that's for sure.
Yeah, no, God forbid. But these narratives mean the other side may make up a story, but we're going to make up a story too. None of this is true, what we're about to tell you in these so-called narratives. These narratives are just stories. And so forget facts, forget a threat analysis, forget whatever it would take to defend our civilization. We're just going to tell you a lie, and we're going to call it a narrative, and parts of it will be true, but overall it's not. And we've lived for the past 20 years with these narratives instead of simply telling the American people that we have an enemy, that enemy means to destroy us, and that we, if we're going to remain free people, must do certain things. And as you've described so well, when it comes to Islam, they just do not want to face that there is an Islamic movement that wishes to destroy the West and the United States. And if that's true, and I think you've demonstrated the most capably that it is true, then we have to do something about it.
Yeah. Well, again, you're being too kind. But the point is that when you look at specifically this phenomenon of Sharia supremacism, this isn't a narrative. This is a doctrine. This is an ideology. This is a plan of action that people who subscribe to it feel is God's will. And by contrast, what we're being told is we can't talk about Western civilization. We can't defend Western civilization as, in fact, a superior program, if you will, to what Sharia does to people, Muslim and non-Muslim alike. It's, as you know, Brian Kennedy, so horrific. It's almost unspeakable. And we have Donald Trump saying in his inaugural address that he is resolved to eradicate from the face of the earth radical Islamic terrorism. Does that begin to provide the kind of clarity that you're calling for and give us a basis upon which we can, in fact, defend Western civilization?
Absolutely. I mean, my God, can you imagine 2 years ago sitting around and not, you know, wondering who was going to be president? The only man who would have had the courage, I think. I mean, Ted Cruz was excellent as well. But other than Cruz, Donald Trump was the only man who would have been willing to stand up and say that radical Islamic terrorism must be eradicated, destroyed.
Particularly from that platform.
It was, yeah, I'm sorry, yes, from that platform. And that is moral clarity. And then we simply have to ask ourselves, if that's true, he wants to do that. I completely believe he means that. What are the necessary steps? I mean, the mere fact that we, this long after 9/11, have to be talking this way is a sign that we have failed up to now. I mean, the real interesting part is, what is it Trump will do? My colleague Angelo Codevilla said shortly after September 11th, he said, you want to do the kind of things so that the other side, 30 years from now, is still sitting around a campfire in the middle of Afghanistan, shaking their heads, saying, how did we ever let that Osama bin Laden do this to these Americans? Our lives now are completely miserable. Well, we didn't do that. And because we didn't do that, we're still talking about it today.
Well, and we are still contending with people who are trying to set fire to our house, not sitting around their campfires in some godforsaken bit of Afghanistan. Brian Kennedy, in terms of what the new president must do to translate this moral clarity into action, to operationalize it, if you will. There's talk about, and I personally am very supportive of, the idea that at a minimum, one of the things he needs to do, in addition, of course, to dealing with the Islamic State and other violent jihadists, they're not unique, they're just one particularly awful manifestation of this, as you know, but also to designate the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist organization, which of course it is. Do you regard that as an essential step as well? And if so, why?
Well, I think step number one. I mean, we cannot go about defeating whatever Islamic terrorist threat exists abroad if we're being manipulated by the Muslim Brotherhood here in the United States.
And do you regard that's what's happened to this point and has contributed to the circumstance you've just described?
Almost completely. As you well know, the Brotherhood has been here in various forms for 50 years, and they have been, by their own understanding, they've been mainstreaming themselves politically and trying to corrupt our miserable house from within. They actually say in their own strategic memorandum, I mean, something that they write down themselves, they have to write it down so that everybody in their group knows this is what they're genuinely about.
Yeah, the plan and destroying Western civilization from within. Yeah, exactly right. The explanatory memorandum.
Right. And I know you can find it on your website. And the mere fact, you know, we have confusion, this moral confusion about calling Islamic terrorism for what it is, or radical Islam for what it is, or Islam, for that matter, what it is. The idea that we're doing that today means that we don't have that moral clarity and we're being manipulated by these operatives within the Muslim Brotherhood and their various organizations like CARE and ISNA and ICNA and others that are very good at tapping in to the politically correct nature of the American political elites. You saw this when the president went to the National Prayer Service.
Indeed. Mohammed Majid, notably, one of the top Muslim Brotherhood operatives in the United States. Brian, there's so much more to talk about, including your passion and mine for protecting our electric grid against electromagnetic pulse and the country against missile attack. I know that these are things that you're leading on and look forward to watching you do so at the American Strategy Group and to collaborating with you as always. Come back to us again very soon. Let's talk about those as well. In the meantime, be well and congratulations on your new venture. Matt Cottinetti joins us next. We'll go into some of this business about the war on Donald Trump and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Matt Cottinetti. Matt is an entrepreneurial sort in the journalistic world. These days, the editor-in-chief of a terrific online resource called the Washington Free Beacon. He has written for, served in fact as the opinion editor of the Weekly Standard, the author of The K Street Gang, The Rise and Fall of the Republican Machine, and The Persecution of Sarah Palin, How the Elite Media Tried to Bring Down a Rising Star. You can find his writings in numerous places, and as I say, from time to time, we get to talk with him here as well, for which we're very grateful. Happy New Year to you, Matt. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be here.
And happy new administration as well. We're just about at the first week mark of the new Trump administration. It is manifesting itself in a kind of blitzkrieg, I think you've called it, in terms of various executive orders and policy pronouncements. Most recently, of course, yesterday with the immigration policies, the construction of the wall. Tell us a bit about how things are going in your estimation.
Well, I think Trump is off to a great start. I think Trump is basically showing that he's governing very similarly to how he campaigned. And that has a few characteristics. One is Trump's tremendous energy, which is he is active every day and often does several different things each day, as well as, on the one hand, doing kind of political stuff and the now, since he's transitioned into being the president, the actions, activities of governing, while also basically toying, playing with the mainstream media, like kind of a cat plays with a mouse. And part of it is, I called it the Trump blitzkrieg even during the transition, because it seems to me the Trump strategy is to press on every front simultaneously with great speed in order to disorient the opposition. And we see something like that happening in his first week as president, where each new day brings a rash of executive orders, first on Obamacare, then on immigration. Some are being planned apparently in terms of United Nations and international organizations. And the totality of these orders kind of leave the Democrats completely befuddled. How do they respond? And meanwhile, the media is obsessed with whatever thing came out of Trump's Twitter account this on a given morning. They're not actually even looking at the policies. I'm sorry, the second day policies were, of course, the pipeline, right? And so he's beginning to make a good on some of the promises he made during the campaign. So to that extent, I think he's off to a good start.
But to the extent that you are, well, at least have a foot in the camp of the media, are you troubled by what we're endlessly told is his propensity to prevaricate, to exaggerate, perhaps at best, and to downright mislead the American people at worst? And it's working like a top if his objective is sort of to deflect the press from his real purpose. But does that trouble you in any way, Matt Cottinetti, or do you think too much is being made of it?
Well, my attitude is basically, you know, when you talk about, say, the stock market, and you ask whether the stock market has considered some type of event, and you say, well, that's priced into the market. I think Trump's use of what he calls truthful hyperbole in his book, The Art of the Deal, is priced into his presidency. This is an aspect of his personality. He likes to exaggerate, especially in reference to himself and to his fame. And I think the media needs to just be careful about not obsessing over every little thing
that comes out of his mouth or out of his Twitter account. The real thing, what matters is Trump living up to his campaign promises? Is Trump furthering this agenda of nation-state populism that brought him into office? And thirdly, is the country improving for the average American? These are the factors that will determine whether he's a two-term successful president or not, not the latest thing out of his Twitter account.
Yeah, excellent point. Hey, Matt, one of the things that's come out of, not just his Twitter account, but his inaugural address and campaign promises and the rest has been his pledge to put America first. And of course, as you know so well, that particular phraseology has some bad history. You've talked about it in a very important way, it seems to me, in your writings at the Washington Free Beacon, namely in terms of a new American patriotism. Would you develop that thought a little bit as to what it means as Trump uses this phrase and what it portends?
Well, I think a lot of people misunderstand why Trump uses the phrase America First. It is true that America First came to be known in the antebellum period of the World War II, and it was used by Americans who were reluctant to become involved in the Second World War. So there is a history to America First, and that is that it was a vehicle that used by Charles Lindbergh and others to oppose American entry or involvement in the Second World War. However, most people don't know that history. I'm not even sure whether Trump knows that history. And what most Americans hear when they hear the words America First is a sense of belonging to a nation, America, and a president who's saying that he is going to operate always keeping that nation's interests in mind. And so in Trump's inaugural, what you saw him doing is you talked about every different type of American, of every color, basically, of every creed, he said, but unifying them under the idea that we all belong to one country, and this country is a unit. And that's very much in opposition to the mainstream thinking, not only of Barack Obama, but also, to some extent, even George W. Bush, which was much more cosmopolitan and much more in the sense of America joining the world community and also welcoming a diversity of peoples and of beliefs. So what Trump is trying to do is say, I'm for America First. I'm putting American interests in mind. And the distinction now is really between insider and outsider. Are you part of the unit or are you not? And if you are, and it's easy to become part of that unit, you're on Trump's side and Trump is on your side. If you're not part of that unit, say if you're a legal immigrant who has committed many crimes, let's say if you were someone who's gotten in on lax visa policies, who's probably more loyal to ISIS than to the United States, if you're, say, the Chinese or Mexicans, who, of course, they want the trade rules to work for them as opposed to the United States, well, then Trump is going to oppose you. I think that's what America First means today.
I think so, too, and I think it is an opportunity to rekindle a certain moral clarity about the nature of this country and rekindle American patriotism as well. Let me ask you, finally, Matt Continetti, about, you mentioned China. One of the things that the Chinese are doing, and by the way, we'll be speaking momentarily to your colleague Bill Gertz, the Chinese seem to be trying to exploit what they perceive as a willingness on the part of the United States to disengage, to put themselves forward as the new global adult or grown-up. Talk, if you will, about the global baloney of China, as you've called it.
Well, I just think it's ridiculous to consider China a responsible power or a grown-up power or even, as some people say, a liberal power. And this is just, I think, the desperation of many opponents of Trump to embrace anyone critical of him. The fact is that China is an irresponsible power. The record is clear in terms of their espionage, both diplomatic, military, and industrial. Their hack of the Office of Personnel Management a few years ago that released millions of government records. Their illegal building of islands and other installations in the South China Sea. Their belligerence toward their neighbors, their occupation of Tibet. There's a reason why Kim Jong-un, the psychopath regime, is able to maintain power in North Korea. China is a bad actor. There's no question about it. It makes me wonder if China is so invested in the status quo, then maybe Trump has a point when he says the status quo doesn't work for America.
Doesn't work for America's interests, for sure. Matt Continetti, we are out of time, I'm sorry to say, but thank you very much for yours today, as always. I look forward to doing this conversation often in 2017. And in the meantime, trust you will keep up your great work at the Washington Free Beacon. Thanks so much for joining us. Next up, as promised, Bill Gertz, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, one of our regulars here at Secure Freedom Radio, one of the distinguished journalists, certainly in the national security space of our time. He is, these days, a senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and also a columnist with a prize-winning column entitled Inside the Ring at the Washington Times. The author of now 7 best-selling books, the latest one of which is brand new, entitled iWar. It's a great privilege to have him with us each week. Bill, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Bill, you've written over the years extraordinarily well and compellingly about China, and it sounds as though Jim Mattis at the Defense Department may be taking heed of some of your admonitions about maintaining the pretense through military-to-military ties that somehow we're actually stabilizing a dangerous situation with the Chinese. That seems to be under review by General Mattis. Talk a bit about that, if you would.
Yeah, basically, this was an Asia Times column that I did, which takes a look at the people that are being selected to take prominent roles in the China policy shops in various parts of their government. And the outlook is pretty good. I think there's going to be a healthy dose of skepticism about the Obama administration's unfettered engagement with China, which has really been contrary to our national security. Basically, the Chinese have been ripping us off for massive amounts of data through cyber attacks. They've gained access to our sensitive military facilities during military exchanges. And if the people that he is selecting get in positions of power, I'm pretty sure there's going to be a curbing of these military exchange program, at least as far as reciprocity. It's going to be, look, we want access to yours. This whole notion of building trust with the PLA is also doubtful. I mean, this is a Communist Party-dominated army that is not a national army in the traditional sense, and thus the notion that U.S. military officers can build a relationship with this communist-dominated army is really the height of naivete.
Well, especially when, as you've documented so well, it's really a one-way street. We show them ours, our most sensitive facilities. We allow them to participate in our naval exercises and the like, and there's none of that reciprocity to speak of. Bill, you were, I know, impressed as I was by the comments of Rex Tillerson at his confirmation hearing in terms of a rather robust attitude, shall we say, towards the Chinese seizure and fortifying of these atolls across the South China Sea from which to project power. And yet a very different signal seems to be being sent by the selection of the next Secretary of the Navy, Philip Bilden, a man with extensive and very cordial, it seems, financial and other ties with the Chinese. What do you make of this sort of mixed signals?
Yeah. First of all, I think Trump has been pretty clear that the South China Sea is high on his priority list because he has spoken out about it several times. And then we saw the State Department nominee, Rex Tillerson, say, look, not only are we going to demand that China halt the building of these islands and the militarization of these disputed islands, but we're going to block China from accessing them. And that certainly that set off all kinds of heartburn in Beijing. So that's a good sign. That position was reiterated by the White House press secretary, Sean Spicer, a couple of days after he made them, saying, yeah, we're going to press the Chinese not to have access to this. That could set off some type of confrontation. Now, on the Navy secretary side, I had a piece in the Free Beacon that showed that there was a big fight within the administration over who should get that post. It's a very significant post because Trump has announced that he wants to build a 350-ship Navy and he wants to add $20 billion a year in shipbuilding. So this is a key position. And everyone thought that Randy Forbes, the former congressman from Virginia, who was the Sea Power subcommittee chairman on the House Armed Services Committee, was a shoe-in for the post. And lo and behold, a financier who spent 20 years in Hong Kong investing in China. And he's clearly a pro-China advocate, because you can't invest in state-run Chinese banks unless you're a so-called friend of China. So this has sent a very troubling signal. I'm sure that his record will be closely examined by the Senate Armed Services Committee when his nomination finally reaches the committee in the next few months.
No, well, I certainly hope so. I don't know the man myself, but his record, as you say, suggests that he's at the very least going to be somewhat at odds with the policy direction that the president seems to be setting. I have no idea what his attitude is towards the Navy or towards rebuilding it and deploying it to protect our interests in the South China Sea, but it does seem to be a mixed signal at the very best. Hey, Bill Gertz, let me ask you about Russia. Jim Mattis is on the record as having taken a very hard line, it would seem, about Russia and its activities with respect to its nuclear buildup and threats, its treaty violations, hybrid tactics that have put it into places like Ukraine and Georgia of late, Syria perhaps, hacking, and one of your specialties, information warfare. Talk a bit about the Mattis view on all of this and what you think it might mean for American policy towards Russia at a time when President Trump has made it pretty clear he's seeking a better relationship with Moscow.
Yeah, this was a piece that I did recently that looked at his formal written statements to the Senate Armed Services Committee. His questions on Russia were answered with much a harder line than it appears that others perhaps in the new administration are taking. And he's clearly aware of the new and growing dangers from Russia. And so I think he's definitely got a big challenge to deal with that. There's no question that the Trump administration is going to try to reset relations with Russia. I think it's doomed to fail, and the reason it will fail is because Vladimir Putin views the United States as its main enemy and is taking steps to provoke and circumvent U.S. leadership, especially in Europe. So this is something that deserves a lot of attention, how the Russia policy will unfold.
Bill Gertz, President Trump's first foreign visitor as president will be Theresa May, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. It's widely speculated that one of the issues they will be talking about will be the future of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Donald Trump has taken a somewhat skeptical view of its continued value. Theresa May is, of course, very committed to it. How do you expect that to sort out, Bill?
Well, I think clearly Trump has made it clear that he thinks that the alliance needs to carry more of its weight. They need to do more for their own defense. His point is being that for too long, the United States has carried NATO with its defense capabilities, and now I think he's going to want NATO to do more, and I'm sure that that will be front and center with his discussions with Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, in the coming days. Whether or not NATO will step up to that is really an important question, because, as you know, the Europeans seem to be have taken a very weak position on defending themselves, whether it's through the influx of refugees and others, or for the military defense. So yeah, this is really something that's going to be debated, and it's very important that they get it right.
Hey, Bill, lastly, we've had reports that some of the tanks that have been deployed in the last days of the Obama administration to Europe, returning American heavy armor there in the face of what seems to be some new threats from the Russians to the Baltic states, members of the NATO alliance, They've arrived with dead batteries and empty fuel tanks. Have you heard anything along these lines? And would it surprise you, given what's happened to the United States military during the Obama years?
I've seen the reports. I'm not surprised. The military's facing a crisis. You know, this is the result of hundreds of billions of dollars in defense cuts under Obama. The military is scrambling just to maintain its forces. This is going to be one of the top priorities of the new administration to try and reverse that decline of our forces. And it's going to take a lot of money.
Yeah.
And, of course, the president also wants to focus on domestic infrastructure. So it's going to be pretty interesting to see how we're going to use a businessman's approach to fixing a lot of these problems.
Indeed. And Mick Mulvaney, the new director of the Office of Management and Budget Designate, is not a friend of this kind of investment in the national defense, I'm afraid. So it will be an interesting time for you to be doing the important work you do, Bill Gertz, at the Free Beacon and, of course, at the Washington Times. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Next up, Fred Fleitz will join us. We'll talk a bit about intelligence reform from the perspective of an intelligence professional. That and more.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Fred Fleitz, my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, our senior vice president for policy. He is these days actively involved in the war for the free world outside of government, but he has a long and very distinguished history of service to our country inside, particularly inside the intelligence community of the United States, having served for some 20 years in the United States Central Intelligence Agency, also as a chief of staff to then Undersecretary of State John Bolton, and as a member of the professional staff of the House Intelligence Committee. A man of many parts, a contributor massively to the work of the Center for Security Policy, including his very important book about the Iran nuclear deal entitled Obama Bomb. Fred Fleitz, welcome back. It's good to have you, my friend.
Good to be here, Frank.
Well, where to begin, Fred? I want to talk, I guess, about a couple of the very topical subjects that kind of are in your general wheelhouse. Donald Trump spoke once again yesterday about the value of and need to be willing to engage in what he called torture. I'm not sure that's actually what he meant, but would you talk a little bit about the usefulness, in fact, perhaps the necessity of augmenting some of the techniques that are in the so-called Army Field Manual that are well-known, well-established, and guarded against by our enemies, I think, on the one hand, and the utility of something that has come to be known as enhanced interrogation?
Yes, Frank, this is worth discussing. The media is having a conniption today because of an ABC interview. And what Trump was referring to is that he believes enhanced interrogation works, which was consistent with the Army Field Manual. And he believes there are instances where this type of interrogation would be needed in extreme circumstances against terrorist suspects to stop a major terrorist attack. And most of the American people agree with that. The problem with the media outrage is that enhanced interrogation, which I don't believe amounts to torture, which is illegal, and we don't support torture, enhanced interrogation has been outlawed. And both CIA Director Pompeo and the Defense Secretary Mattis said they won't use it. And what Trump said exactly was that it would be up to them if they wanted to do this, and he would not do anything inconsistent with the law. So really, this is more fake news. Trump didn't say, I'm going to go around torturing people, but you wouldn't know that from watching CNN.
Yeah. And in fact, the utility of enhanced interrogation is something that James Mitchell, in his new book of that name, has underscored, is very real. In fact, I was struck by the comments by one or more of the folks subjected to waterboarding in the Gitmo context of jihadism now being countered worldwide, and the fact that you need to use techniques like waterboarding in order to give those who are being subjected to them a basis for finally giving up their information. They're not supposed to do it. They're supposed to withhold it. So I think this is a place where the president is right, and if his use of words was not as elegant as one might want, it's the fundamental point is well taken. Fred, you've spent a lifetime, as I said, in the intelligence community. One of the questions that Donald Trump is, I gather, mulling is whether to perpetuate the existing bureaucratic arrangements of the intelligence community with a Office of Director of National Intelligence at the top of the pyramid. What are your thoughts on that subject? Should it be revised so as to remove that layer of bureaucracy?
Well, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, headed by the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, was supposed to be a small office to coordinate intelligence to make sure that the right information was shared by all the right agencies to stop terrorist attacks, because we know 9/11 might have been prevented if different agencies had shared everything they knew with other agencies. The problem is the ODNI has grown into this huge bureaucratic layer that has made intelligence much less efficient, much more risk averse, and frankly, much more political.
Give us a sense of how large it is now, Fred.
Well, I have heard estimates that they have at least 2,500 employees. I think it's larger. And it was supposed to just be, you know, under 100. And I've spoken to former CIA director Woolsey, who said, look, when I was head of all of the intelligence agencies, he used to be the DCI, Director of Central Intelligence, we managed the whole community with a couple dozen officers. We don't need thousands. And he's exactly right. This is wasteful. It's led to a lot of duplication. And I see strong indications that the Trump administration plans to streamline our intelligence operations and to substantially cut back the ODNI. I hope they get rid of it, but that may take difficult to pass legislation.
Yeah, I hope they get rid of it as well, Fred. But at the very least, streamlining, removing the bloat and the bureaucratic, politicized layer, as you say, is critically important to the intelligence community doing what we need it to do. Fred, a man who's very much under attack at the moment from those who I think are really gunning for his boss, Donald Trump, but are for the moment setting their sights on him, is, of course, the National Security Advisor to the President, Michael Flynn. You know General Flynn, of course. What are your thoughts on the charges that are being bandied about you know, conniving with the Russians and other things seemingly aimed at taking him down?
It's just shameful that this man who has devoted his life to defending our nation is being subjected to these political cheap shots. National Security Advisors, before they enter office, they're supposed to consult with other nations. This man wasn't in league with Russian intelligence officers, and it's just so outrageous that this is being done to Flynn. You know, there was a last-minute claim that there was a counterintelligence investigation against Flynn. That's now been discredited. It's outrageous that this is being done, but there were no serious counterintelligence investigations of Hillary Clinton's email server and her staff and the Clinton Foundation, where there were real reasons to believe that sensitive intelligence had been compromised. The Obama administration has no interest in doing that. All they wanted to do was to discredit Republicans and this man who is a patriot.
Yeah, discredit, and I'm afraid really to undermine. And it's outrageous and I think needs to be resisted at every turn, especially this idea that he was somehow in league with the Russians by virtue of not only his contacts with the ambassador, but going off to Moscow to sit down with Vladimir Putin at an event. Do you have any insight into what he was saying to Vladimir Putin?
You know, Flynn has been criticized because he's done television appearances on RT. Many conservatives have done that. He's done appearances on many international media outlets. And the fact that he was talking to the Russians, I think we have to talk to the Russians. That doesn't mean he's in league with them. I know Flynn realizes that Russia's a threat, and that we had to find a way to deal with this threat. But Russia's also a nuclear-armed power. We're not going to start bombing them to change their policies. We have to find creative diplomatic solutions. And I think Flynn is someone who will help us do that.
Yeah. My understanding is that one of the messages to Putin was there's a new day coming. The United States is going to be under formidable leadership once again. And I think that message was conveyed and certainly taken aboard by Putin. Let me ask you, Fred, one final question. You and I first met many years ago when you were at the Central Intelligence Agency, and one of your responsibilities and concerns was what was being done at the United Nations against our interests. We have reports now that Donald Trump is going to promulgate some new executive orders with respect to cutting back on funding for the UN and quite possibly a review of multilateral treaties. Your thoughts quickly on those issues?
If you think the United States government is politicized, you ain't seen nothing compared to the UN. It's long overdue. I completely support it. The UN should be promoting our interests, not that of Islamists and enemies of the United States.
promoting our interests would be a radical change, and I don't expect that anytime soon. But supporting it to promote our enemies' interests is folly, for sure. Fred Flights, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you so much for both your visit today and the work you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up and come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.